My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Coming up on Heard on the Street, why slumping car sales could be a warning sign and our activist investors running wild.
Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Hello and welcome to Heard on the Street, the podcast. We are the Wall Street Journal's home for commentary on all things financial all over the world. Reporting from London, I'm Alex Frangos, filling in for our regular host, Miriam Gottfried, who is on assignment. Later, we are going to talk about the combative, rough and tumble world of activist investors. But first, I want to bring in my colleagues, Justin Lehart and Spencer Jacob in New York, to discuss arguably the most important industry in the world for investors, cars. Hi, Justin. Hi, Spencer. Welcome.
Good morning.
Hey.
Great to have you here. Justin, the economy is humming along. Unemployment is low. Consumers are spending. But the beating heart of the American economy, car sales, are falling. Down. Car sales are down 10% in March, if we don't count SUVs. What is going on, and what does this mean for investors?
Yeah, we've seen this. We've seen a retreat in car sales. We're seeing car companies are jacking up their incentives. There seems to be a lot of inventory. We're also seeing used car prices fall. So part of what's happened is that there was a lot of catch-up car buying from the recession, and that has finally passed. So now we may be coming to the point where we're, you know, we find a plateau or we find out what the run rate of car sales should be in the U.S. And that run rate is probably lower than what we've been seeing.
There's, for those not au fait with the terminology of car sales, there's a SAR, seasonally adjusted annualized rate that cars sell at. And late last year, I mean, they were really going like hotcakes. We were hitting levels that we had never seen, or at least not seen since the kind of the boom days of early in the previous decade. What's the right level? Does anyone have any idea? Is there, you know, obviously the population is larger than it was then, but was it high or not?
It's the right level is probably lower than what we're seeing.
And, it's 18 million is what it ran last year?
Yeah, well, that's it got up to toward the end of last year. And then right now it's been running around 17 or so, a little more than 17 so far in the first quarter of this year. The right level is probably somewhere in the 16. So you can ask different people this, and they're going to give you different answers, of course. So what you have to do is you look at what's the stock of vehicles, what's population growth doing, what's the population of licensed drivers doing? And then there's a replacement cycle, too. So people put all that together and they get, you know, somewhere around 16, depending on who they are.
So we have a period coming up now where maybe people are not buying cars. If they're not buying cars, what are they buying? I mean, this is going to be great for, you know, Walmart and Macy's and Amazon and everyone else. If they're not buying cars, they can be buying other stuff.
Well, that's the big question. So the other thing that's happened since the recession is the recession really created a much more careful U.S. consumer. And this is something that has happened in the past. After periods of high unemployment, if people go through those, they just tend to be, you know, permanently a lot more careful, especially younger people. The people who will be coming into buying more cars right now, the millennial generation. They kind of graduated into a horrible economy. So they're going to be really cautious about spending. And just because they're not going to have that big, you know, car, you know, payment coming up, and they may still have that car payment, that doesn't mean that they're going to go and buy something else.
And, you know, one of the probably the most interesting stat in your column were the credit terms and the length of the loans and what a high percentage of loans were at lengths that
7 years
exactly that you had never even seen before. They were
so people
unheard
are
of.
People are tied into owning their cars for a really long time if they have these really long credit terms.
Well, otherwise, it lowers your payment, right? So it was more it wasn't cheaper, but it was more affordable to buy a car. And so the terms are a lot better than they were during the boom or during, you know, the pre-crisis years, right?
Right, right. And thing about that, you know, if you bought, and there, you know, there are these 7-year payments. If you bought on that 7-year payment, right, there's something coming out of your paycheck for 7 years, right? So just because you're not buying the car doesn't mean you're not still spending on the car. And that that also hurts.
I have two questions for you, Justin. Yeah. One, is it a coincidence that this happens just as the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates? I mean, there's so much of this demand has been fueled by, like Spencer just said, these incredible terms for buying cars. I mean, I guess that's my first question. My second question is, isn't this a counterexample to this idea of the careful consumer, that in fact they've been out there buying cars, buying big SUVs, not being scared at all to load up the garage with an extra car?
Well, we still have a saving. The saving rate is up relative to where it was. And people, remember, a car is not a purely discretionary item. Cars are sort of this. There are a lot of things like this, right? It's sort of this interesting thing, right? You need a car. Right? In America, you need a car, or a lot of people do. So
or
you
two
have
or three.
To buy it. Yeah, right. You have to buy it. And then there's this sort of discretionary thing on, the tail fins or how much car you're going to get. There's also, in terms of SUV sales or light truck sales, light trucks include pickups and SUVs, right? There is a gas price element to that. So gasoline prices are still low. And when gasoline prices are low, people tend to buy more of these SUVs and pickups. Also on the SUV and pickup end, there's a lot of small businesses where the sale sort of counts as that. It's sort of like, if you're a plumber, you buy a truck. It also relates to your business. So there is, right, there has been some strength for small businesses lately. So that's probably helping things as well.
But I mean, so how is this going to kind of play havoc with, if not the real economy, then with the stats that we use to gauge the economy? I mean, you go out and you buy a $28,000 car. Let's say you get 0% for 7 years. I mean, you're only paying $4,000 a year, but it shows up as a $28,000 purchase. It shows up in retail sales. The car maker gets the money from a finance company. You're not going to spend an equivalent amount on something else because no one else is going to give you that kind of sweet financing for a fridge or an iPhone or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it may not just play. I mean, it's going to hurt actual spending. And that's, I think that's the thing to think about is that this is, as car sales turn over, it gets a little harder for the economy. So
have there been previous cycles where, you've had a kind of a slump in car sales and it's been virtuous for other forms of consumption, be retailers or travel companies or who knows, however people spend their money?
I think I would have to tease the numbers out a lot to make that argument. Usually when car sales really turn over, it's bad for everything.
Yeah.
It's usually a sign of the economy is really slowing down.
Right. Well, although the cause and effect is, does it go? It's the biggest purchase that most people make. I mean, someone who doesn't own a home, it really is the biggest purchase you make by far, right? If you're not willing to kind of, go out and, get a newer vehicle, then you're not very confident.
Yeah, if you're worried about your job or something like
right.
that, you're
so
not going
to
just with your old car.
Right, it coincides with scary periods or periods when you're afraid of losing your job.
Yeah. Right. Sounds like pretty bad stuff. We're going to have to end it there. We're going to take a break. And coming up, the next frontier for those loudmouth activist investors everyone loves to hate.
My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
I'm Veronica Daggert, and I want to retire rich. How about you? Then listen to the Watching Your Wealth podcast. We'll help you get there. For more information, check us out at WSJ.com/podcasts and find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Spotify.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Welcome back to Heard on the Street, the podcast. I'm Alex Frangos. Activist investors, they agitate, they cajole, they force their way into boardrooms. Now they are increasingly active in a place where people used to think such strategies didn't work, Europe. I have with me Heard on the Street's Stephen Wilmot here in London, along with Spencer Jacob and Justin Lehart in New York to talk to us about activists. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Alex.
First question for you. We have seen activists go after some iconic European names recently, agitating for changes at Volkswagen, aerospace giant Safran, and industrial giant ThyssenKrupp, along with others. Why are activists in Europe getting bolder?
Well, yeah, there aren't just these high-profile cases, but also the statistics show that there's been an increase overall. So it's not just a question of kind of headlines. I think the key change is actually not among the activists, but among traditional fund managers. And these are under political pressure, and I think under pressure from their clients as well, to behave more like the owners rather than just the holders of capital. So basically to become more active themselves and to behave more like owners who control stuff and ask for stuff, ask management to get stuff done that the management wouldn't necessarily think of themselves. And I think because of this pressure, they are much more willing than they used to be to support activists when they do come along.
You have a kind of more aggressive activist investor who comes in, demands certain things, and they'll have the more passive guys who normally sat on their hands.
Absolutely. And of course, the activists depend on these guys for their votes. You know, a whole point of proxy disputes is that, you know, you're getting other people on your side. So the cultural norms around whether you support management team or the activist investor are crucial to the success of any strategy. And I think that's been the key change. I mean, I think also there's been sort of general internationalization and fragmentation of corporate ownership in Europe. So there are more US and UK fund managers basically on the shareholder registers of old German and French companies than there used to be. I think there are still technical reasons why it's hard for those fund managers often to vote. And so the key thing is actually local fund managers being a bit more aggressive. And so, for example, there's a situation with Tesco at the moment, which did a deal.
Big UK... Yeah, grocery retailer.
Big UK retail. Obviously, Warren Buffett used to be an investor, but sold out because they went through some very tough times. But it did a deal which is being disputed by two traditional fund managers, and you know it looks very much like activism, but it's not by Elliott, it's by Schroders, which is a big UK fund manager.
And Schroders is what we think of as kind of big, boring mutual fund
exactly,
kind of company.
Yeah. So I think you're seeing more activism among traditional fund managers, and that's the key to what's changing.
You're right that in each country, unique challenges to doing that. In the Netherlands, the Stichtings with Axo Nobel, and other, you have dual board structures in Germany. You have completely different rules in France. It's easier said than done.
Let's talk about Akzo Nobel, which is this big paint and specialty chemicals company that's under assault from American rival PPG. Elliott Management is a big shareholder of Akzo and wants them to do the deal. Akzo doesn't want to do it. So what's Elliott's recourse here?
Yeah, well, this is a particularly live situation. I mean, only yesterday PPG came out and reiterated its desire to team up with Akzo. So yeah, it's definitely ongoing. The problem for Elliott is that there are these priority shares that Akzo has issued in the past, which are owned by this Stichting, which is the Dutch word for foundation, and basically that gives the Stichting the sole right to appoint board members. And so Elliott is arguing that it can replace the board members, that can it remove the board members, which is true, but you know, from our discussions with legal experts around this, it looks like it can't actually, you know, there's nothing stopping Akzo, basically the Stichting, just coming and proposing more stooge board members who don't want to do the deal.
So get rid of one set of stooges and you get delivered a new set. So they can't replace them and then demand, okay,
that's
here are
what it
board
looks
members
like.
That
I mean,
we want.
Elliott kind of disputes this, the fact that there's this confusion around this issue just highlights the difficulty that activists face in Europe, because you come across a new jurisdiction and suddenly a whole new set of concerns that you didn't really realize existed kind of crop up.
Does that, I mean, let me ask, well, this is one thing that you didn't address in your column, but it's difficult to quantify, but I mean, activists come in when they sense that there's some action, a divestiture or something else that could be done to improve things. Are European companies, is there low-hanging fruit in terms of efficiencies? You know, if you could be omnipotent and come in and change things, would you get greater bang for the buck?
I think that's a really interesting question. And, you know, the Kraft Heinz bid for Unilever in February did highlight a quite dramatic divergence between the margins of US companies, you know, in that particular sector and European ones, you know, with Unilever and Nestle around 15-16% and Kraft Heinz and Mondelez and all this sort of, well, not Mondelez because it's a bit of a different case, but anyway, Kraft Heinz in the high 20s. I mean, it's tempting to kind of see European companies as these low margin laggards that would just do wonderfully if only some aggressive US activists came along and shook things up. And I think the danger with that thinking is that there are in corporate codes in particularly continental Europe, i.e. not the UK, rules around observing different sets of stakeholders.
More than just shareholders. Yeah, others. You've got to be thinking about community and
workers. Axo Nobel has, you know, I was speaking to someone who said, you know, the statement that Axo Nobel first came out with when PPG made its intentions clear was you'd never get away with that statement from a UK corporate. You'd have to reference shareholder concerns above everything else and find reasons. Whereas they said, oh, no, we've got a broad array of stakeholders. In the current debate, Elliott says, a majority of shareholders want you to talk to PPG. Axo says that doesn't necessarily mean a majority of stakeholders.
No, this gets at the crux of the debate about activists, which is they can boost the stock price in the short term, but do they handcuff management in making, you know, good long-term decisions? So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get at that question. I'm going to ask all three of you, are activists good for markets or just good for themselves?
Keep tabs on the markets. Listen to WSJ's Money Beat podcast for straight talk on Wall Street that's right on the money. WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
I want to get a snap judgment from the three of you. Stephen, you go first. What's your view? Are activists good for markets or are they just after a quick buck?
Well, thanks for the pop quiz. I would say they can be good for markets. I mean, there are obviously some examples. GM is a topical one where it's not entirely obvious, apart from this is just a load of financial engineering. But I think in the case of Axo, Elliot's doing asking some really pertinent questions. I think in the cases of the German companies I've looked at, you know, the Sevi and the activists that get involved in that market, they really stay on board for the long term, and they actually, yeah, they can really help.
Okay, case by case, and sometimes it works. Spencer, and then Justin. Spencer, what do you think?
Okay, well, I would say, and just answering more generally, that activists, of course, they're in it for themselves. That's why anyone does anything in financial markets. The question is, are they doing any good for you? You know, generally, investors are there for, you know, price discovery and things like that, so it's a kind of a social, societal good. I think activists are that way, but more so, because they're sticking their necks out, and they're trying to push for some efficiencies. They don't always succeed, but that's capitalism. You know, it's creative destruction. I think that
Justin,
it's good.
Justin?
Yeah, I mean, what Spencer said, right? It's an invisible hand thing, right? They're in it for themselves, but, you know, there's that invisible hand. Maybe, you know, so I would say definitely for markets. Maybe the other question is to say, are they actually good for the economy, right? Are they good for, you know, things in general? Some of the things that activists do can be pretty disruptive for, you know, ordinary people. So that's another, you know, aspect of what's happening. And I think that is probably part of the crux of the problem with them coming into Europe, where there's more of a stakeholder idea than just a shareholder idea when it comes to you know, who owns and controls the company.
We're going to have to end it there. That wraps things up for this week's Heard on the Street podcast. Please join us every week for the latest in global investing. For more, please check us out at wsj.com/heard. That's wsj.com/heard. You can also email us with your comments, suggestions, or questions at heardpodcast@wsj.com. From London, I'm Alex Frangos. On behalf of the rest of the Heard on the Street team, thanks for listening.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.